Today is Tuesday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. and Mexico pledge tough security after a group of migrants try to cross the border. A dire U.S. government climate report that the president doesn't seem to think has merit.
I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
How U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs are impacting the beer industry.
I don't think we necessarily expected to have probably our single biggest expense, packaging materials, have be directly impacted by tariffs.
Also ahead, dictionary.com's word of the year. It's all on today's International Edition. Mexican authorities have deported dozens of Central American migrants arrested after attempting to rush the southern U.S. border at San Ysidro Sunday, prompting U.S. officials to use tear gas. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that.
Customs and Border Protection Chief Kevin McAleenan says some 69 migrants were arrested on the California side. He says they were among 1,000 migrants who tried to rush the border, though Mexico says there were half that many. American agents fired tear gas to stop them, which McAleenan says is allowed under the Border Patrol's use of force policy. While Mexico says it will boost security near its border, President Trump's keeping up the pressure on the Mexican government, tweeting it should do whatever it has to. But the migrants will not be allowed into the U.S.
Well, about 5,000 people are being housed at a sports stadium in Tijuana after traveling thousands of kilometers in search of asylum to escape poverty and violence at home. Many are expressing frustration at long wait times for their cases to be heard. San Ysidro is the busiest U.S. land crossing, and authorities there currently process about 100 asylum seekers per day. Joining us now to discuss all the latest developments is immigration attorney Ashkan Amami with the PATH Law Group in Los Angeles. Mexico is asking the U.S. for an investigation into the use of tear gas on migrants. Has this ever been done before by U.S. Border Patrol agents?
To my knowledge, there's never been an event where migrants have been tear gassed at the border. Obviously, using police force or tear gas has been very common in our history. Obviously, the civil rights movement, it happened also here in Los Angeles in 2007 at an immigrant rights rally. So it's not unprecedented in its use against minorities and immigrants. But to my knowledge, this has never happened at the U.S. border just because of the way that our laws are set up, particularly as it pertains to people seeking refuge here.
Does Mexico have any sort of case for suing the U.S. over this? The Trump administration is claiming that they stormed over the border into the U.S. Where were these people when they were tear gassed? Were they in the U.S. or were they still on the Mexico side?
Many of them were on the Mexico side because the ports of entry are shut down. I mean, if they were storming the border, then presumably many of them had not made it across yet. And once they're across, they get arrested and detained. It's not a tear gas issue anymore.
My understanding is the president is stopping people from seeking asylum. What happens if they get across?
If they get across, then U.S. law by statute mandates that they may claim asylum. Okay, once they're on U.S. soil, it's very, very clear. Section 1158 of the code claims that any non-citizen who's physically present in the United States may claim asylum. So the stakes are high to avoid having these people actually set foot on U.S. soil.
So would you say that's the reason for the built-up enforcement, the tear gas, et cetera?
It's hard to say for sure, but it looks like that is the goal here. At least one of the goals here, is to keep people off of U.S. soil in order to avoid creating some sort of legal dispute, which the administration would almost inevitably lose just because the statute is so clear.
And what about the legality and the human rights factor? Are there human rights laws against tear gassing women and children or children?
There are. Whether they're enforced or not is one question. But the other question is that there are reports that there were rocks being thrown at border officials.
Okay.
And they used tear gas and rubber bullets to defend themselves. However, obviously, a lot of women and children were tear gassed.
Mm-hmm.
So whether this was excessive force or not is really, really hard. I mean, that's really what the question is, whether this was excessive or whether this was justified. Whether or not they do be subject to sort of to international law. I mean, theoretically speaking, Mexico has a right to not have another country use police force within their borders. So it creates sort of a very tricky, unprecedented legal issue, sort of an international legal issue. I think that it's fair to say that a country has the right to exercise force within their own borders. Remember, these people are not in the United States. They're technically in Mexico on Mexican soil.
What about the legality of refusing entry to asylum seekers, which sounds like that's happening? And the president again was talking about how these were dangerous people, but all we've seen is pictures of women and children getting tear gassed.
U.S. asylum laws are very, very clear. So by statute, any person who is physically present in the United States can claim asylum. Okay, so anyone on U.S. soil, no matter how they arrived here, whether it's legally or illegally, or they dropped from outer space, it doesn't matter. They can claim asylum. Now, for those who enter at a designated point of entry at customs, let's say at the border, the Tijuana border, those people are not technically on U.S. soil when they're at customs. So what the law requires is that customs officials ask these people whether they have a credible fear of returning home. If the answer to that question is yes, then those people should be given a credible fear screening by the Department of Homeland Security, which basically begins the asylum process in the United States. What's happened now under Trump is that the administration is saying that nobody can claim asylum unless they enter through a designated point of entry, okay? Meaning that if you cross in the desert or, you know, you get here through some other illegal means and you're not at a designated point of entry, then the administration is banning your right to claim asylum. However, first of all, that's illegal. And second of all, if you are going to a port of entry these days, you're likely being turned away and you're not even being given a credible fear screening. So it's really the administration's way of trying to suffocate the options that people have to claim asylum here.
What about the people? Are they not getting word that or being informed that this administration could potentially be not welcoming? Are they at all concerned about that or the fact that they could be separated from their children?
Sure, I imagine they are, and I imagine the entire world knows that this administration is hostile. I imagine the entire world knows that family separation is a huge issue. I mean, it was international news just a couple months ago. And I think that it should tell you a lot that these people are very, very well aware of the risks of being separated from their children. They're very, very well aware of the hostility that this administration has towards immigrants, and they're choosing to come here anyway. That gives you an idea of how dire things are for these people, that they're willing to risk these things just for possibility of living a safer life in the United States.
All right. Thanks for being with us. That's Ash Kanamami with the PATH Law Group in Los Angeles. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Special counsel in the Russia probe says ex-Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort lied to the FBI. The U.S. embassy in the Democratic Republic of Congo closed because of a terror threat. A strong earthquake in Iran injures more than 700. And GM North America's plant closures are disappointing to President Trump and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. By the year 2090, when days are too hot or smoggy to work, it will cost the U.S. economy up to $155 billion each year in lost productivity. That's one economic impact cited in the National Climate Assessment released Friday by 13 U.S. federal agencies. It states that without substantial and sustained global mitigation and regional adaptation efforts, climate change is expected to cause growing losses to American infrastructure and property and impede the rate of economic growth over the century. President Donald Trump was asked about the report Monday and dismissed it as alarmist.
I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
Trump has for many years rejected the scientific consensus that human activities are the main drivers of climate science. Since his first day in office, he has worked to undo regulations that aim to cut the greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet.
Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been, and that's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good. So I want clean air. I want clean water. Very important.
The report said deaths from extreme temperatures will cause $141 billion in losses per year. The analysis also points out that this is no longer something that will happen, but is happening. Joining us to discuss is Dr. Peter Glick, a world-renowned climate expert and founder of the Pacific Institute, who worked on the original climate assessment.
Well, this is a study that was done by 13 federal agencies, and it was prepared under a law that requires the U.S. to do an assessment every few years of the risks of climate change for the United States. This is the fourth national climate assessment, and what it tells us is really what we've sort of known all along, which is we know that humans are causing climate change, not something in the future, but happening now. We see more and more actual impacts today of climate change in terms of changes in our water resources and our snow and our temperatures and fire frequency and sea level rise, all of the things that unfortunately we're witnessing every day. And it says we need to act to make sure that we're prepared for those impacts we can't avoid, and we work to reduce future impacts to prevent them from being even worse.
Is it possible to reverse this in any way if there was enough action, or is it really just too late for that? And is it more a question of just literally preparing for what's to come?
There are two pieces to that. We are now in a world in which we know humans are already changing the climate. That is unavoidable. And so we have to prepare for those impacts that we can no longer avoid, that in fact, many of which we're starting to see. But at the same time, we also have to work as hard as possible to reduce the emissions of the gases that are causing climate change so that we don't continue to accelerate the bad changes that are happening. And it's possible to reverse that in some ways. We're not going to stop climate change, but we can certainly slow it down. And it's going to take a long time now, but eventually we're going to have to work to even get rid of some of the greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere.
Considering that we've been hearing about this for many years, and my understanding is that the level of carbon emissions that are going into the atmosphere have not been reduced at all.
Well, the rate of increase has been reduced. The first thing you have to do is slow the accelerating train, which we're beginning to do now. You know, we're seeing much more aggressive investment in renewable energy. Coal plants are closing in many places. There's a tremendous amount that needs to be done, but we are slowly making progress. The bad news from this report is that we are already experiencing impacts of human-caused climate change, and we're going to have to deal with that as well.
What kinds of things are we going to have to deal with?
Well, the bad news is there's just a huge long list of them, but we know that sea level is going up, and we know that poses enormous threats to our coastal communities. And again, we've seen with recent hurricanes the damage that's possible from these extreme events along the coast. We know the temperatures are going up, and we've seen the impact of rising temperatures on fire frequency and fire intensity and fire speed in the western United States. We know that we're losing our snowpack in the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevadas in the west because of rising temperatures, and that affects water resources and water quality. The report also talks about basically broad impacts on the economy. It says we could lose 10% of our economy by 2100 just dealing with climate impacts. So, you know, this isn't some abstract thing. This is our economy. This is our health. This is our lives. And that's one of the reasons why this report is so important.
Obviously, climate change doesn't just impact people here in the United States. This is a global problem. What do we as a country do, or can we do, as far as solutions to an administration that seems hostile to the science? The president just Monday said he doesn't believe the report.
Yeah, it's very hard to have coordinated global action on this global problem without the active participation of the United States and the fact that we have an administration that is so hostile to actual science. And as long as that's the case at the federal level, as long as we're not as a country participating in global efforts, it's going to slow the globe's ability to deal with this problem, and it's going to worsen the impacts in the long run. The good news is that even without federal action, we see states and local communities taking action. The state of California has a very aggressive program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we're not the only state here to do that.
And we have two more years, possibly six, with this administration. I would imagine those would be 2 to 6 years lost. How detrimental to the world would that be?
It's a big deal. The impacts that we see today are the consequence of not having taken action 10 and 20 years ago to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. If we had paid attention to the science information that we had 20 years ago when the first national climate assessment came out, the impacts we'd be seeing today would be much less. And so the longer we we delay addressing greenhouse gas emissions, the longer we delay cutting the concentrations in the atmosphere, the worse those impacts are going to be. We can't afford to lose any more time, really.
That's Dr. Peter Glick, climate scientist and founder of the Pacific Institute. Ukraine's parliament approved President Petro Poroshenko's call to impose martial law in parts of Ukraine bordering Russia and the Black Sea on Monday, a day after Moscow attacked and seized three Ukrainian ships and their crews in waters off Russian-annexed Crimea. Russia opened fire on them and wounded several soldiers, a move that risks igniting a dangerous new crisis between the two countries. I talked about it with Professor Leonid Petrov, visiting fellow at the Australian National University.
There are contradictions and the accusations and the blame game is going on, but this dispute was bound to happen after the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula by Russia in 2014. The territorial dispute is not ending with the eastern Ukraine and the peninsula. There's also the port facilities, there's also naval bases. And what happened is actually probably the precursor of a major conflict, or probably the conflagration of a major war between the former members of the former Soviet Union.
Ukraine says they were fired on and six crew members were injured. Does that automatically indicate to you that would be cause for serious retaliation from the Ukraine side?
I don't think that Ukraine is in a position to retaliate in a military way, but diplomatically, I understand that President Poroshenko has already called upon the United Nations Security Council to have a meeting and discuss the situation around the Crimean Peninsula. Six people injured. I understand that it's not life-threatening injuries, but still, potentially, it may escalate and repeat this skirmishing. And it reminds me of what was going on in or around the Korean Peninsula for the last 70 years, for the last 65 years, since the armistice agreement. We saw on numerous occasions when the naval battles or the skirmishing across the border left many people injured or dead.
Russia doesn't seem too concerned whenever the world community comes out condemning any particular actions that may be aggressive. What's to stop them from continuing?
Well, I think that Russia knows the risks. And it's a message, very strong message, both internationally, that Russia is not going to give up its control of the Crimean Peninsula and the adjacent maritime provinces, and the freedom of passage is going to be will totally depend on Moscow's goodwill. And also, it is the message to the domestic population in Russia that Russia is a strong military power, and the imperial ambitions of Moscow are expanded beyond its territory, and Russia is going to protect its national interests. But also, and it's worrisome, that Russia is also sending message to the Ukrainian population, who are now preparing for the presidential election early next year.
How dangerous of a situation do you think this could turn into?
It may be very dangerous. It may be lethal. And what is particularly worrisome is that Russia is a nuclear armed power. Ukraine used to have nuclear weapons as well, and it gave up its nuclear arsenal to Russia after the signing of the 1994 Budapest Agreement. So I believe that now Ukraine feel regretful about this decision. They cannot protect their territorial integrity. And what I'm worried about is that Ukrainians might find a way to retaliate and do it in a non-conventional way.
What would that be?
Well, Ukraine still has the stockpiles of old Soviet weapons, weapons of mass destruction, in particular chemical weapons, bacteriological weapons. Who knows what kind of weapons can be stored in Ukraine and which groups may have access to this. So if President Poroshenko is seen as either too weak or too indecisive about defending the national integrity and territorial integrity of Ukraine, some groups, rogue groups, might get access to the uncontrolled or poorly protected stockpile of weapons in Ukraine and then decide to retaliate against either Russian troops stationed around the Ukrainian border or against the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk. So potentially without Western involvement in this conflict, they're not going to be World War III, but definitely Ukraine is going either to lose more territories or potentially even lose its statehood.
In the past, other U.S. administrations have taken a stance against Russia's, but it would appear that this administration doesn't seem to take that stance at all. all when it comes to getting involved in anything, really. How much of a concern would it be if the U.S. just bowed out and basically just said we're not getting involved or took a position in favor of Russia?
Well, looking at President Trump's most recent tweet, it looks like the White House is going to benefit from this situation, saying to the effect that Russia is doing what it wants and the NATO is weak because it's over-relying on the United States and underpaying its membership fees. So I think President Trump will try to mobilize NATO, well, in order to first remove the burden of financial support from the United States only, more to the Europeans, and if Europeans have more access and to the assets and try to demonflex the muscle again, it may not look good and don't go well with Moscow as well. So by so doing, the United States is, again, has a dilemma. By sort of encouraging the West to be strong, on the one hand, it's good to, you know, face the danger from the East, but also that Moscow may also feel threatened by the strengthening of NATO and even consolidate more power and even take Ukraine completely from the orbit of Western countries. So the big geopolitical game may unfold from this moment. And if Washington, D.C. is prepared to see the rising militarism in the East and the only response is that to strengthen the NATO, I don't think it's going to make peace any safer.
All right, Professor Leonid Petrov, visiting fellow at the Australian National University.
50 meters, constant velocity. 37 meters. 30 meters. 20 meters. 17 meters, standing by for touchdown. Touchdown confirmed.
That's the sound of a flight controller with the U.S. space agency NASA as its latest Mars probe touched down on the red planet after traveling hundreds of millions of kilometers through space over the course of 6 months. The probe, called InSight, landed safely Monday on the Martian surface. Engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, erupting in cheers, as you heard, as they received data showing the spacecraft had survived a dangerous descent. InSight project manager Tom Hoffman said those last minutes before landing were agonizing.
My heart was basically, I think, just stopped beating for 7 minutes. I don't know if that's healthy or not, but then when we got the indication of parachute deployment, which was absolutely terrifying thing to think about, we got that positive. And then listening to Christine Soleil call out as we got closer and closer to the surface, every time she made a call out, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck would start rising a little bit higher, a little bit higher.
JPL Director Michael Watkins said InSight will provide a vital trove of new information about Mars and all planets, including possibly how the Earth developed.
In the coming months and years even, the history books will be rewritten about the interior of Mars. I personally have to say the first day, the landing day, and these first couple of pictures of a place no human has ever seen before also remind us that in order to do science, we have to be bold.
Excitement about the latest landing was high, with viewing parties held across the United States. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo. Coming up on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, Dr. Amesh Adalja, MD from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, joins me and my co-host, VOA health reporter Carol Pearson, to talk about what many regard as the deadliest flu pandemic in history. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it is a sign of the times, as Dictionary.com has announced its word of the year. AP correspondent Mike Hempen reports.
This year's word is misinformation. Jane Solomon, a linguist in residence at Dictionary.com, says the rampant spread of misinformation is providing new challenges for navigating life in 2018. She says with misinformation, there's self-reflection, evaluating our own behavior, and a call to action. Dictionary.com believes that understanding the concept of misinformation is vital to identifying it and helping curb its impact. Earlier this month, Oxford Dictionary selected toxic as its word of the year. I'm Mike Hempen.
U.S. tariffs on imported steel and aluminum, a move by the Trump administration to bolster the domestic industry and protect U.S. jobs, are starting to have a far-reaching impact on different sectors of the U.S. economy, including the growing craft beer industry. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, one thing that wasn't in the business model for a new brewery in the Midwestern United States was the cost tariffs would have on each can of beer.
When Dan Catt opened Good City Brewing in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2016, he never imagined a trade war between the Trump administration and China.
I don't think we even contemplated that that administration would exist. We always planned to can our products. I don't think we necessarily expected to have probably our single biggest expense, packaging materials, have, you know, be directly impacted by tariffs.
Catt's cans are made of aluminum, about 30% of which is originally sourced from foreign suppliers, mostly China. The foreign aluminum is now subject to a 10% tariff.
The price of aluminum is a concern. We buy in large quantities. When we buy cans, we buy in lots of about 215,000 cans at a time.
Which Catt says only lasts about 3 months.
When we go back to market, we expect to see price increase on cans. Even if they go up a penny, that's like 15% of the price. Packaging materials are our largest expense in the brewery beyond the liquid. We fully expect to see our cost of packaging materials go up in 2019.
Tariffs are taxes on American citizens. When we put tariffs on steel and aluminum, it drives up the cost of steel and aluminum in the United States.
Brian Kuhl is the executive director for Farmers for Free Trade, a nonpartisan group that is actively campaigning against tariffs. Tariffs, President Trump maintains, are working.
We have taken historic action to bring back American jobs by cracking down on China's very abusive trade practices. But that's going to work out. That's going to work out. Taking in billions and billions of dollars in taxes from China never happened before. But they want to make a deal, and that's good, because I like them and I like their president, President Xi. And we're going to make a deal, I believe.
We don't think that the current trade war with China is going in the right direction. We think it's increasing costs for U.S. manufacturers, it's increasing costs for U.S. farmers, and it's decreasing export opportunities. We're causing long-term damage to American agriculture and our ability to compete in foreign markets.
Dan Catt doesn't export to a foreign market, but he does depend on it for the aluminum to package his product and for steel used in the equipment that makes the beer.
We do buy equipment, stainless steel, that comes through China. So that's a concern for us as we look at continued growth and continuing to build capacity. I think we're definitely feeling a rush on anything that's metal. People are asking for premium prices on.
Catt says his company will continue to grow regardless of the short-term impact of the tariffs. But he hopes the U.S. and China can reach an agreement on trade before he has no choice but to pass the increased costs on to his customers. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.